Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a case that's really a must-know, especially if you're diving into employment law. Janet Brush v. Sears Holdings Corporation.
Yeah.
Think of this as your streamlined guide to understanding why this 11th Circuit decision still resonates, particularly when we talk about retaliation claims.
Exactly. Yeah. We've sifted through the court opinion and, you know, related materials to bring you the essential insights on Title VII retaliation and this really pivotal concept known as the manager rule.
Right.
Our mission today is to, well, cut through the legal complexities and give you a clear understanding of the implications.
Okay, let's get right to the core of it. A question that immediately jumps out is, can a manager face retaliation from their employer for actions they take as part of their job? Specifically, when those actions involve addressing potential discrimination within the company. That's the central legal puzzle we're unpacking today.
It's a fascinating intersection, isn't it? Between an employee's job responsibilities and their rights under anti-discrimination law. To really understand why the court ruled the way it did, we need to start by laying out the specific factual scenario that brought this case to the 11th Circuit.
Right. So Janet Brush was a long-term employee at Sears, serving as a loss prevention district coach for 15 years.
Quite a while.
Yeah. Then in 2007, a critical incident occurred. She was assigned to investigate a sexual harassment complaint filed by another Sears employee, Mrs. Doe, against her supervisor.
And this is where the situation becomes quite nuanced. During her investigation, Brush conducted a private interview with Mrs. Doe. Now, importantly, this interview was conducted against Sears company policy.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Yes. During this private conversation, Mrs. Doe disclosed a deeply disturbing fact. She had been raped by her supervisor. However, she made it clear to Brush that she did not want the police to be involved and didn't even want her husband to know.
Wow. That puts Brush in an incredibly difficult position, navigating both company policy and Mrs. Doe's personal wishes. So what action did Sears take upon learning this information?
Well, Sears did respond to the harassment complaint by terminating the accused supervisor.
Okay, so they took some action.
They did. However, they made the decision not to report the rape to law enforcement, citing what they considered to be inconclusive findings and, crucially, respecting Mrs. Doe's explicit desire against police involvement.
And this decision by Sears is really the catalyst for Brush's subsequent actions and the legal case itself, isn't it?
Precisely. Brush strongly disagreed with Sears' decision not to report the rape. She firmly believed that such a serious crime should be reported to the authorities, regardless of Mrs. Doe's stated wishes.
So she was quite vocal about it.
She was. She actually voiced her criticism of Sears' handling of the situation quite publicly within the company, insisting on the necessity of a police report. That paints a really complex and, well, tragic picture, putting Brush in an incredibly difficult situation with competing obligations.
And the consequence for Brush expressing these strong views.
Shortly after she made her criticisms known within Sears, her employment was terminated.
Which, as you might expect, led to legal action. Brush filed a lawsuit against Sears, arguing that her termination was an act of unlawful retaliation under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
This brings us to the core legal questions that the courts had to consider. There were essentially two central issues at play. First, were Brush's actions in this specific context considered protected activity under Title VII?
Okay.
And second, did Sears unlawfully retaliate against her for engaging in that activity?
The initial court to hear the case, the district court, made a ruling. What was their conclusion?
The district court actually sided with Sears, granting them summary judgment.
So when the district court granted summary judgment, what exactly did that signal about the evidence presented at that stage? Can you remind us what summary judgment means in this context?
Sure. It meant the court found that even taking all of Brush's factual allegations as true, Sears was still legally entitled to win the case because there was no genuine dispute over a material fact that would change the outcome under the law.
Right.
This avoids a full trial because the judge determines that one party is entitled to judgment as a matter of law based on the undisputed facts.
Okay, so Sears won at the district court level. Brush then appealed to the 11th Circuit. What was the outcome there?
The 11th Circuit ultimately affirmed the district court's decision, meaning they agreed with the lower court's ruling in favor of Sears.
And it didn't go further.
Well, to provide finality to the matter, the Supreme Court later denied certiorari.
And for our listener, the law student, What does denied certiorari signify?
It means the Supreme Court declined to hear the appeal. They aren't obligated to take every case, you know? By denying certiorari, they let the 11th Circuit's ruling stand as the final legal precedent in this particular case within that circuit.
So the 11th Circuit's decision is the key ruling we need to understand. And the central legal concept that really shaped their decision seems to be this manager rule. Can you break down what that rule entails?
Certainly. The court's central holding was that Brush's actions in this specific context did not qualify as protected activity under Title VII.
Okay.
This is where the manager rule becomes critical. Essentially, the manager rule states that when an employee is acting within the scope of their normal job duties, which in Brush's case included investigating employee complaints, their actions are generally not considered protected activity under anti-discrimination laws like Title VII.
Why is that distinction made?
Well, from a policy standpoint, this rule aims to prevent employees from simply labeling their routine job duties as opposition to gain protection from legitimate performance management or termination. Without this distinction, employers could face significant challenges in managing employees whose job descriptions involve handling complaints.
Okay, so just performing your job, even if that job involves investigating potential harassment or discrimination, doesn't automatically grant you protection against retaliation under Title VII.
That's the crucial point. The court reasoned that for a manager's actions to be considered protected, they typically need to step outside their usual role and personally oppose discrimination.
How would they do that?
This could involve, for example, filing their own formal complaint of discrimination or actively and explicitly challenging an established policy or practice by the employer that is demonstrably unlawful under Title VII.
And in Brush's situation, the court didn't interpret her actions in that way.
Exactly. The court emphasized that Brush did not file a personal complaint alleging discrimination against Sears. Furthermore, they found that she wasn't challenging a specific policy or practice by Sears that was clearly unlawful under Title VII.
Right.
Her primary disagreement was with Sears' judgment call not to report the rape to the police.
Which leads us back to Sears' decision regarding the police report. The court specifically addressed why Sears' inaction on reporting wasn't deemed a violation of Title VII.
Yes. The court highlighted that while Title VII prohibits discrimination and mandates that employers take reasonable steps to address and prevent harassment in the workplace, which Sears arguably did by terminating the supervisor.
Right, they did fire him.
It doesn't necessarily impose a legal obligation on employers to report every potential crime that might be disclosed during an internal investigation to law enforcement. They also gave weight to Mrs. Doe's explicit desire not to involve the police in this instance.
So Brush's strong insistence on reporting the incident, while perhaps driven by ethical considerations, wasn't considered opposition to something that Sears was legally required to do under Title VII.
Precisely. The court drew a very important distinction here between disagreeing with internal company procedures or a company's judgment in handling a sensitive situation and actively opposing practices that are actually unlawful discriminatory practices under Title VII. They clarified that protected opposition requires challenging conduct that violates the statute itself.
So let's say if a manager disagreed with a company's diversity training program, would that be protected activity if they've got concerns?
Not necessarily, unless they could argue that the training program itself fostered or perpetuated discrimination in violation of Title VII. Simply disagreeing with the content or effectiveness of a diversity program is likely a disagreement with internal procedure, not direct opposition to an unlawful discriminatory practice.
That distinction between disagreeing with procedure and opposing an unlawful practice is really critical to understanding this case.
It is.
So, as the court essentially said, just because you disagree with how a company handles something internally, even if it involves a serious issue, doesn't automatically qualify as protected activity against discriminatory practices under Title VII.
That's a key takeaway. As the court articulated, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, disagreement with internal procedures does not equate with protected activity opposing discriminatory practices.
Okay, so what are the broader implications of this manager rule, particularly for individuals in management roles and for HR professionals navigating these complex issues?
Well, the primary implication of the manager rule is that it sets a boundary on when managers can successfully claim retaliation protection for actions taken as part of their routine job responsibilities.
Right.
To gain that protection, they generally need to demonstrate that they stepped outside their usual duties and actively opposed what is demonstrably unlawful discrimination in a more direct and personal manner.
like filing with the EEOC.
Exactly, like filing a charge with the EEOC or explicitly challenging an unlawful company policy.
And what about the interplay between an employer's obligation under Title VII to address workplace harassment and any potential legal or ethical obligations they might have regarding reporting criminal activity uncovered during an internal investigation?
This case really highlights that Title VII's primary focus is on eradicating discrimination and harassment within the workplace. While there might indeed be separate ethical or even legal obligations outside of Title VII that could compel reporting certain criminal activity.
Just state laws, maybe?
Potentially, yes. But Title VII itself is primarily concerned with ensuring that employers take reasonable steps to prevent and correct discriminatory behavior. It doesn't explicitly mandate the initiation of criminal proceedings in every instance.
So even if a manager strongly believes that a company's chosen course of action, while perhaps addressing the Title VII aspect, is ethically problematic in a broader sense, if they aren't challenging a practice that violates the specific provisions of Title VII, they might not be protected from retaliation under that particular law.
That's a crucial understanding. Disagreeing with company procedures, even when those disagreements are based on strong ethical principles, is not automatically considered protected activity under Title VII unless that disagreement is fundamentally rooted in an opposition to an unlawful discriminatory practice as defined by Title VII.
Now, shifting our focus directly to you, our listener, the law student, what are the key lessons from Brush v. Sears that you should be taking away as you continue your legal studies?
For you, understanding this case is a valuable lesson in dissecting retaliation claims under Title VII. It really underscores the importance of the prima facie case.
Ah, yes, the prima facie elements.
Remember, a plaintiff typically needs to establish three elements. One, that they engaged in protected activity. Two, that their employer took an adverse action against them. And three, that there was a causal link between the protected activity and the adverse action.
Okay.
As you'll see in your studies, understanding the protected activity element is crucial in any retaliation claim, and the Brush case provides a really important limitation on what qualifies in the managerial context.
And in Janet Brush's case, where did her argument ultimately fall short in the eyes of the court? It was that first step, wasn't it?
Yeah,
precisely. The court concluded that her actions, while perhaps well-intentioned, did not meet the first element of the prima facie case. In this specific context, due to the application of the manager rule, her actions were not deemed to be protected activity as defined under Title VII.
So, as you analyze future retaliation cases, a key question to consistently ask yourself might be, was the employee genuinely opposing a practice that violates Title VII, or were they primarily expressing a disagreement with the employer's business judgment or internal operational procedures?
That's the critical analytical lens to adopt. It's about carefully discerning whether the employee's actions were specifically directed at combating unlawful discrimination as defined by the statute itself.
So, to bring it all together, the central finding in Brush v. Sears significantly clarifies that retaliation protections for managers have limits. It's not enough to simply be engaged in job duties that touch upon discrimination issues.
Right.
For those actions to be protected from retaliation under Title VII, there generally needs to be a clear demonstration of the manager stepping outside those routine duties to personally and directly oppose conduct that is actually unlawful under Title VII.
That's a concise and accurate summary of the court's core holding, and it really prompts you, the listener, to consider the delicate balance at play. The intersection of an employee's professional responsibilities to their employer, their own internal ethical compass, and the specific legal protections afforded by anti-discrimination laws when they encounter potential workplace misconduct.
Yeah, it definitely raises some tough questions.
It certainly does. It raises complex ethical and legal dilemmas that warrant ongoing reflection and analysis. Think about scenarios where the manager rule might lead to particularly challenging ethical and legal situations. What kind of conflicts might arise for managers trying to navigate their duties and their sense of what's right? Something to definitely mull over.